very happy birthday today to Rita Kajar of West Bend. Happy birthday, Rita. We hope that this is a very happy day for you. And that's the only birthday we have today. So we're moving now to my announcements, if I can get the page turned here. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Linda with our obituaries.
From Des Moines, Marie Elena Jacobo, age 78, passed away Friday, February 16th. Marie was born November 20th, 1945, in Los Angeles, California, to Arthur and Edna Lopez Reyes. Marie made friends everywhere she went, and she never knew a stranger. She taught by example and instilled in her children to be good citizens. Marie was a guiding light to immigrants and those around her. She loved empowering people to learn and succeed, teaching them to utilize resources around them to be successful in navigating systems and their environment. On her own and through her work with Luna, she proudly taught many women how to speak English, drive, and be independent. Marie was an active member of Our Lady of the Americas Visitation Catholic Church. She was involved in the church choir and prayer group. She received recognition for her dedicated involvement through the years to Latinos Unidos. Marie was a proud property manager and, above all, a proud mother and grandmother. She loved flowers, cooking, gardening, dancing, and listening to music. She is survived by her son, Raymond Lopez, partner Diane, and their children, Rebecca, partner Andrew, Polly, Rachel Lopez, and Luke Lopez. Her son, Roy Salcedo, partner Ann Genasi, and their children, Samuel and Anthony Salcedo. A son, Rafael, partner Angel Jacobo, and their children, Miguel, Isaac, and Amari Jacobo. Son, Ronnie Jacobo, and his children, Vincent and Benicio Jacobo. And daughter, Linda Donna, partner Edgar Herrera, and their son, Enzo Herrera, and many special friends. Marie was looking forward to meeting her first great-grandchild soon and see her granddaughter, Rebecca, become a mother. She was preceded in death by her husband, Jose Luis Jacobo. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, February 22nd, at Hamilton's Funeral Home on Lyon Street in Des Moines, with a rosary at 7 p.m. The funeral mass will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 24th, at Our Lady of the Americas Catholic Church, that is on East 9th Street in Des Moines. Burial will follow immediately at Glendale Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family to establish an endowment to help others in her memory. And condolences can be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Robert Leroy Bergstrom, nicknamed Bob, who was 101 and from Des Moines, passed away peacefully in his sleep on Thursday, February 15th, at Wesley on Grand in Des Moines. Bob is survived by his daughter, Elizabeth Betsy, partner Kevin Lundy, his granddaughters, Kristen Lundy and Rachel Lundy, all of Des Moines. His brother-in-law, Leland, partner Diane Gustafson of Cedar Rapids. His sister-in-law, Elaine Gustafson of Algonquin, Illinois, and several nieces and nephews. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 23rd, at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 24th. This will be at the Mission Church on Ridgemont Drive in Urbandale. Burial will be in Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines. Full obituary at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Robert Franklin Harrison, 83, of Ankeny, died Monday, February 19th, as a result of complications from RSV. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on Friday, February 23rd, at Memorial Services of Iowa, that's at 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard. Burial will follow at the Ankeny Memorial Gardens. He's survived by the love of his life and his wife of 57 years, Sharon L. Harrison, sons Robert D. Harrison and David G. Harrison, sister Joy E. Harrison, grandsons Samuel J. Riley J. and Henry W., and granddaughter Elizabeth M. Harrison. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the National Stearman Foundation. The details on that can be found at stearmanfoundation.org. Full obituary at ankenymemorial.com. Donald Don Abel, A-B-E-L, of Ankeny, passed away on February 18th. Visitation will be held on Friday, February 23rd, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Ankeny Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, February 24th, at 1 p.m. at the Ankeny Funeral Home. Burial will be at the Masonic Cemetery following the service. Don was a member of Teamsters Local 90, Auburn Masonic Lodge, Zagazig Shrine, and the Scottish Rite. He's survived by his wife, Susan, daughter, Christine, grandsons, Donald, DJ, and Jacob, and brother, Charles. The full obituary can be found at ankenyfuneralhome.com. Donna Carpen, 94, passed away January 27th. She was born in Woodward, Iowa, on June 9, 1929, to Ralph and Lottie Miller Wernley. Donna is survived by her children, Cheryl Daniels and Andy, partner Charisse, Carpen, and extended family. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, February 24th, from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens on Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Following visitation, there will be a graveside service at 1:15 p.m. at Pine Hill Cemetery in Des Moines. You can view the full obituary at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Richard Leroy Lowry, and that is spelled L-O-G-H-R-Y, of Des Moines, passed away unexpectedly in his home on February 13th. Richard Leroy Lowry was born April 24th, 1957, at Broadlands Medical Center in Des Moines, to Clifford Carlo Lowry and Margaret Elizabeth Allen Capper. He was a proud Marine veteran, proud father, grandfather, great-grandfather, brother, and uncle. Upon leaving the military, he married the love of his life, Diana, and helped raise her two daughters and loved them like his own. He unexpectedly went to be with the Lord on February 13th. He leaves behind his daughters, Jeannie Kern, partner Chris, and Shelley Fought, partner Alan, grandchildren Shelby Kaiser, partner Travis, Tony, Michaela Williams, partner Jonah, DJ Sanford, partner Ashley, Preston Kern, Cheyenne Kern, and a grand pup named Chaos Marie, Chaos Marie Fought. Great-grandchildren Ember, Paisley, Mason, Abram, Ivy, Winston, Lexi, and Bentley, brothers Orville Sr., partner Ramona, John, partner Jean, Roger, partner Lisa, and Jim, step-siblings Patricia Thompson, Victoria Fichter, Juanita Brower, Christina Young, Nicholas Allen, and Norma McVeigh, 30 nieces and nephews, 35-plus great-nieces and nephews, and 4 great-great-nieces and 1 great-great-nephew. He's preceded in death by his parents, Clifford Lowry, Margaret Allen, David Allen, grandson Tristan Jean Kern, nephew John Buddy Lowry, and nephew Matthew Sasser. Funeral services for Richard will be held Friday, February 23rd at 2 p.m. at Walker Merrick Billings Funeral Chapel with a visitation from noon to 2 p.m. Burial will take place at Rose Hill Cemetery north of Clarinda following the service, and memorials can be made to your local VA office.
Continuing now with obituaries, we have Bob Curl, or Curly. Let me spell that last name. It's K-U-R-R-L-E. From Des Moines, John Robert, known as Bob Curl, passed away February 14 at Scottish Rite Park in Des Moines. He was 92. Bob was born on November 29, 1931, in Jacksonville, Illinois, to John Albert and Geraldine Lamb Curl. In 1934, the family moved to Winona, Illinois, where the elder Curl established a dry goods store that would ultimately expand to include 4 locations. He graduated from Winona High School and Drake University. Bob was a proud member of the SAE fraternity and served as chapter president his senior year. Upon graduation, he joined the U.S. Navy, attaining the rank of lieutenant junior grade as a communications officer on the aircraft carriers Wasp, Essex, and Yorktown. He married Greta Appleton, the love of his life, on June 15, 1958. They first met in kindergarten and attended high school prom together. Bob worked with his father and subsequently owned and operated Curl's department stores until retiring in the early 1990s. He was active in Bethany Lutheran Church, Winona Lodge, number 344 AF and AM Rotary Club. Those are two different things. Winona Lodge, number 344 AF and AM, the Rotary Club, the Chamber of Commerce, Habitat for Humanity, and other local organizations too numerous to list. He served on the board of Winona State Bank from 1982 until 2014, when he and Greta moved to be closer to family in Des Moines. Bob loved the outdoors, whether a tree standing at or at Wrigley Field. In his 60s, he fulfilled a lifelong dream of learning to fly, earning his private pilot's license and contributing much gray hair to his wife and children. He was an avid runner, winning 5K medals into his mid-80s. His hand-carved duck decoys were locally recognized for their craftsmanship, and his woodworking talents with cradles, airplanes, and rocking horses are treasured by his grandchildren. He was endlessly inquisitive and experienced much of the world through travels in the Navy and with Greta. In his final years, he relived college days by enjoying Drake basketball games and sharing the occasional beer with his somewhat younger fraternity brothers. Bob was predeceased by his wife Greta, sister Nancy, and daughter Martha in infancy. He is survived by his sister Priscilla of Peoria, Illinois, as well as children Polly Clark, partner Jim Slife of Des Moines, Gail Bradburn, partner Jeff of Litchfield, Illinois, and Jonathan, partner Diane of Arlington, Virginia. 7 grandchildren, 5 step-grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and many beloved nieces, nephews, and extended life members. A celebration of life for Bob Curl will be held in Des Moines on February 27 at 4 p.m. in the penthouse on the 12th floor at Scottish Rite Park on Woodland Avenue in Des Moines. A reception will follow. A celebration of life and graveside service will be held in Winona, Illinois at a date to be announced. Memorials may be directed to the Scottish Rite Park Good Neighbor Fund, to the Winona, Illinois Cemetery Association, or Bethany Lutheran Church of Winona. Online condolences are welcome at the islescare.com website. John Allen Tomei, Iowa City, 47, passed away on Sunday, February 18. His loss was unexpected, and his family is profoundly saddened. He was their foundation. John was born August 9, 1976, in Iowa City, the son of Alan and Sally Frank Tomei. His youth was filled with friends, sports, and mischief. His friendship, formed over a love of Babe Ruth or while riding bikes through the neighborhood, were his most treasured. Let me read that sentence again. His friendships, which were formed over a love of Babe Ruth or while riding bikes through the neighborhood, were his most treasured. As with many Iowa City-bred kids, John had a complicated relationship with his beloved Iowa Hawkeyes. After graduating from Regina High School in 1995, John checked his Travel the World boxes. With his friends, John went backpacking through Europe, skydiving in New Zealand, and made questionable yet incredible memories. John graduated from Kirkwood Community College with an associate degree before starting his career in construction. He worked with his dad, worked on his own, and even spent time out east with Bazaar Homes before becoming construction project manager at the University of Iowa. He was a hard worker, often stubborn, and always determined to do things his own way, all of which was possible until he met his partner, Maggie Baker. She pushed him, challenged him, and together gave him true purpose in life. His three children, Nellie Grace, Patrick John, and Sophia Ann, were the greatest gifts from God. They were his world, and John loved them with his whole heart. John's unconditional love, strength of spirit, and unending faith were truly showcased in the way he cared for his entire family, including his brother Eric, sister Lori, and all his nieces and nephews. John was blessed to come from two large families who filled his childhood with love, a love he later shared with his own children. John is survived by his partner Maggie Baker and their children, Nellie, Patrick, Sophia. Father, Alan Tomei, mother, Sally Frank, sister, Lori Allen, and her children, Evan, Olivia, Aiden, and Alexandra, all of Iowa City. His brother, Eric Tomei, and partner, Lindsay, and their daughter, Ava, of Tucson, Arizona. His maternal grandmother, Mary Frank, of Iowa City, and many aunts, uncles, and cousins. John was preceded in death by his grandparents, LaVon and Edward Tomei, and Paul Frank. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 23rd at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Iowa City, with a rosary recited at 3:30 p.m. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 24th at the church. Private interment will be held at St. Joseph's Catholic Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the John Tomei Memorial Fund, which will be used for his children. Online condolences may be left to the family at the Lansing Funeral Home website. Christina D'Astilio Smith of Des Moines passed away on February 18 at Trinity Center at Luther Park. She was 87 years of age. Christina was born November 1, 1936 in Auburn, New York, to Patrick and Ruth D'Astilio. She retired from Northwest Bank. After retirement, she worked for the Des Moines Public Schools in Metro Care. She enjoyed playing bingo and was an avid Cubs fan. Christina is survived by her husband of 68 years, Morris Smith, children, Wade, and partner Julie Smith, Jr. The second child is J.R. Smith, then Christy and partner Scott McConaughey, and Margaret, partner Scott McKinney, grandchildren Mike Norris, Ben Norris, Chad Norris, Tracy, partner Brett Levang, Todd Smith, Aaron Smith, Patrick Smith, Danielle McKinney, and Nicole Garduno. 11 great-grandchildren and a host of extended family and dear friends. She was preceded in death by her parents and her brother Patrick D'Astilio. The family will greet friends from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday, February 25, at Hamilton's Southtown Funeral Home on Southwest 9th Street. She will be laid to rest at Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery in Des Moines at 10 a.m. Monday, February 26. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Animal Rescue League of Iowa in loving memory of Christina. Condolences may be expressed at the Hamilton Funeral Home website. And finally, Virgil Buffington of Colo. Virgil Dean Buffington, who was 79 years of age, passed away peacefully on February 19 of complications from dementia. He was born on October 5, 1944, to Clifford and Anna Buffington. He grew up in Colo, Iowa, where he developed lifelong friends, a passion for sports, a love of horses, and a dedication to his parents, siblings, and the family farm. Virgil is survived by his children, Joe Buffington of Blue Springs, Missouri, Andrea Peel of Little Rock, Arkansas, grandchildren Caleb Salmon and Braxton Peel, brother Crandall Buffington, sister-in-law Cindy, partner Dean Dooland, nephews Dean and partner Jeannie Ruffington, and Toby, partner Heather McCarter, nieces Patty Fraley, Luann, partner Rob Zumwalt, Sandra, partner Pete Oliver, Renee Marcelli, Brooke, partner John Sanborn, and Taran, partner Josh Klutz, and several great nieces, great nephews, cousins, and friends. Virgil is preceded in death by his wife, his parents, sister Carol Buffington, and brothers Darwin Buffington, Mike Buffington, and Gary Buffington. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, February 24, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Colo, with burial to follow at St. James Cemetery. Visitation will take place from 12:15 until 12:45 p.m. at the church prior to the service. Rasmus and Ryan Funeral Home in Nevada is handling arrangements. A complete obituary and condolences may be shared with the family at the Rasmussen Funeral Home website. And we do have one death notice that is not accompanied by an obituary. Beverly Jane Collins, age 71, of Des Moines, died on February 17. Hamilton's funeral home is handling the arrangements. Service time is 12 p.m. on February 27 at Hamilton's funeral home. It does not say which Hamilton's location, but I'm sure their website would have that information. Interment will be at Iowa Veterans Cemetery.
Going back to the main section, the UAW regaining foothold after contract wins. At least one plant predicted to unionize this year. This from Detroit. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain expects to unionize at least one non-union plant this year, possibly more. In fact, in the next week or so, Fain told the Detroit Free Press the union will announce other non-union automaker plants where 30% and 50% of the workers have signed cards to unionize. It already has reached the 30% level at Mercedes-Benz and Hyundai plants in Alabama and 50% at Volkswagen Chattanooga in Tennessee. Fain said all he needs is one plant where 70% of the workers have signed cards, then take it to a vote and win. That would provide the momentum to win more, he said. But unionizing auto plants in the South has been a daunting challenge. Fain said if the union doesn't get a win, don't count him out. Anything worthwhile, it's worth the work, Fain said in an interview. I believe we'll see success in the near term, and I think we'll see a victory in the near term. But we're in this for the long haul. UAW membership is far below its 1979 peak of 1.5 million. The union currently has almost 400,000 active members and 580,000 retired members. Fain and the UAW are in a key moment. The union is riding high after big contract wins against the Detroit 3 automakers last fall, as well as a swell in labor activism and public support for unions in the past year. According to the Labor Action Tracker, a collaboration between Cornell University and the University of Illinois, labor activism has steadily risen in recent years. The number of work stoppages last year increased by 9% to 470 strikes compared with 433 strikes in 2022. The database showed that high-profile strikes, including the SAG-AFTRA strike and the UAW's stand-up strike, accounted for about 350,000 of the 539,000 striking workers last year. We haven't seen in many years, really decades, as favorable an environment related to unions and as positive an image related to unions that we're seeing right now, said Harley Shaken, a labor expert and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. All of that coming together is favorable for the UAW, but favorable and success in organizing are not the same thing. Still, this is the moment. The union launched its effort to organize non-union automakers last November after it achieved what is widely considered a record contract win with a targeted strike strategy against Ford Motor Company, General Motors, and Stellantis, the owner of Jeep, Ram, Chrysler, Dodge, and Fiat. The new contracts with the Detroit automakers included substantial wage gains and a return of some concessions made in past bargaining, such as cost of living adjustments. Now the UAW has a web page where non-union employees can sign cards to unionize. The drive covers nearly 150,000 auto workers across 13 automakers, including electric car makers Tesla and Rivian. The union has other backing, too. 33 U.S. senators sent letters to CEOs of non-union automakers last month, urging them not to interfere in organizing efforts. That came after the union filed unfair labor practice charges in January against Honda in Indiana, Hyundai in Alabama, and Volkswagen in Tennessee, accusing each of illegally union busting as workers organized to join the UAW. In reaction to the UAW's charges against the automaker, spokespeople for the targeted automakers disputed claims of union busting and said the companies support workers' rights. So far, VW has the most workers signed up. Earlier this month, the UAW said half of the nearly 4,000 employees at Volkswagen's Chattanooga plant signed cards. At the end of January, the union said more than 10,000 auto workers across the 13 non-union companies had signed cards. Volkswagen Chattanooga hit the 50% milestone within 60 days of the union's start of the organizing drive. Fain said the union will announce soon other plants that are closing in on 50%. We want to organize all of them, Fain said. There are organizers everywhere, and there are organizing committee people in these plants. We're tracking and assessing where people are and appointing resources. Volkswagen Chattanooga is the German automaker's only assembly plant in the United States. The UAW said that if 70% of the workforce there signed cards, an organizing committee made up of plant workers will demand that the company recognize the union. If it does not, the UAW will file the cards with the National Labor Relations Board and take it to a plant vote. The speed of getting to 50% at the VW Chattanooga signals to some labor experts that the UAW may succeed there first, but it won't be easy. This is an important moment. There are factors aligning to help the union from the labor market to favorable rulings by the NLRB to public opinion of the union, said Peter Berg, a professor of employment relations at Michigan State University. When that happens, the company's resistance increases. With any sort of rise in power comes the rise in resistance. The UAW has a history of failing to organize Volkswagen's Chattanooga plant. The first union vote there was in 2014, and the union felt confident a clear majority of the workers favored the union, but the Republican leadership in Tennessee mounted a major campaign to vote no, and it succeeded.
And that brings us to the end of the first shift for the Des Moines Register for the last 90 minutes. Your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Doug Kretzinger and Teresa Whitaker. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Teresa with our next article.
Okay, we're going to go to the opinion section. And our first Your Turn column is by Andrea France. Student journalists deliver cause for optimism. If you are reading this, you are part of a diminishing group, those who still read newspapers as part of their information consumption regimen. According to a November 2023 survey by the Pew Research Center, only 38% of Americans say they follow the news closely. That's down from 51% just 8 years ago. Despite demands for accountability, fairness, and balance, Americans are largely drawn to the equivalent of fast food information drive-thru, otherwise known as social media news. An October 2023 Gallup poll makes this picture even more bleak. Of those surveyed, less than one-third, 32%, expressed a great deal or fair amount of confidence in full, accurate, and fair reporting by news media outlets. As a journalism professor for more than three decades, these statistics, alongside other ample evidence of rampant global misinformation campaigns, are enough to make me occasionally look back wistfully at my first full-time job at Walden Books. Selling books to people who wanted to read them was an easy proposition by comparison. So what gets me out of bed in the morning? The next generation of journalists and the promise they bring to a field that needs them. The students who populate my classes right now are mostly Gen Zers, born after 2000. I never mastered the art of the video games they play. We mostly listen to different music, though we can master mutual respect for the generational icons we each point to as the greats. Their lightning-fast texting skills elude me. That I get up at 5:45 a.m. and read three newspapers before work every day confounds them. My coming-of-age backdrop was Watergate, the AIDS crisis, and calls for civil rights. Their coming-of-age backdrop was an insurrection, a global pandemic, and calls for civil rights. Okay, maybe we're not that different after all. As the stats that began this piece indicate, I have fewer students these days who walk into my classes with the unshakable conviction that they will be the next Nellie Bly, Bob Woodward, David Halberstam, or Ida B. Wells. Truth be told, most wouldn't recognize those names. But there are some who are genuinely open to asking the hard questions about the world around them. They are more likely to pursue those truths, wielding tools like audio, video, and graphics very different from those aforementioned journalism titans. But they know well how people choose to consume news and are better positioned to reach audiences where they are in this digital age. They are also innovative at filling community information gaps before they even graduate. An example of that innovation, Iowa doesn't yet face the same news desert problem that neighboring Nebraska faces. According to the local news initiative at Northwestern University, Marion is Iowa's lone county without any local news outlets. Next door, Nebraska has 11 in the same boat. But it's the edge of that desert that is most concerning. Iowa has 20 counties with just one news outlet. Thus, at any point, news desert creep is not only possible, it's likely. According to the same 2023 report, between 2005 and 2022, Iowa lost 50% of its journalists. How are students bridging that reporting gap? Earlier this month, the University of Iowa's student news organization, the Daily Iowan, announced it had purchased the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun and the Solon Economist, two nearby community weeklies. The plan is that student journalists will staff the papers under the mentorship of seasoned editorial staff. Presumably, without the sale and the student reporters it ensures, local coverage in those communities might well have dried up. Student journalists are also offering their digital expertise to community newsrooms as interns and producing content across platforms to meet the diverse needs of audiences. Their multimedia news platforms not only buzz with vital, interesting stories about their campuses, but experiment with dynamic ways to tell them. As a result, I learn from the stories my students choose to report and how they report them. For example, recently, one of my seniors, Joshua Teeks, explored the complex reasons for diminishing deer herds in Iowa using audio to tell the story. He knew that our mobile society, who consume more scientific stories, tend to gravitate to audio. I am no scientist, but his great sourcing, insightful questioning, and outstanding audio production skills helped me better understand a problem I knew little about. And so I celebrate Student Press Freedom Day on February 22nd. Today's collegiate journalists are the future for American journalism, and ensuring they have the freedom to do the work is definitely what gets me out of bed in the morning. And that again was from Andrea France, who is a professor of digital media at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake and executive director for the Society for Collegiate Journalists.
Okay, I used to think I was a storyteller, but not a journalist. And this is written by Joshua Tiggs. You just heard his name. On February 2nd, 2023, I came face to face with a label I had resisted throughout my collegiate career. The conclusion of the Iowa College Media Association's award ceremony traditionally culminates by naming the Pat Peserik Student Journalist of the Year. That night was no different. I knew I had been selected as a finalist for the distinguished award, and I was already grateful for being considered among the best collegiate storytellers across the state of Iowa. As the speaker outlined the qualities of the selected award winner, the room seemed to fade away. My leg began to bounce. My heart fluttered as I made eye contact with my professor, Andrea France, who reached out and grabbed my hand. The comfort in that hand symbolized the guiding principles she had helped instill in me throughout my college career to that point. Those principles were grounded in core journalistic values. The ICMA official continued speaking. I heard, quote, "unbiased contributors to democracy," end quote, through the speakers, followed by, quote, "intensive researched reporting had aspirations to assist in restoring trust in the media," end quote. I immediately recognized the guiding principles as I lifted my head and heard my name announced as the 2022 Student Journalist of the Year. Suddenly, there I was. A self-defined multimedia storyteller undeniably embracing the role of a journalist. Receiving an award like this would have seemed crazy to me a few years earlier. As I prepared to enter college, I knew I had a fascination with the field of media, but I was adamantly opposed to being labeled a journalist. Growing up in a society hypercritical of reporting made me deeply wary of being seen as an, quote, "enemy of the people," end quote. Many sources told me that journalists do little good, inflame emotions, and further divide people. But, of course, I could not have been more wrong. Over the course of my college career, I discovered a love for storytelling and providing a voice to the voiceless. Whether I wanted it or not, those passions morphed me into a journalist, reporting on stories about education, agriculture, science, and law. I began to recognize the fearless mentality required to ask hard questions, listen to answers, and put those answers in context with further research, something necessary for community advancement. As I gathered and told stories across platforms, I started to understand that journalism truly is the foundation of democracy. It holds the powerful accountable and highlights issues affecting the many. Thorough, ethical journalism advances society by granting access to information, allowing for informed decision-making and opinions. Undeniably, news media have the power to drive public conversation, but what I have recognized is the field does not take lightly the responsibility that accompanies this power. As a storyteller, yes, a journalist, I have been driven to discover the truth and advance audiences with what I have learned. Journalism is driven by truth, accuracy, and fairness. I attribute my dramatic shift in mindset to the stories I have been able to tell, the experience I have gained in the field, and my own awareness of what good journalism offers audiences. Despite attending a private university where the First Amendment might not apply, I have never been told, quote, "no, you cannot pursue that story," end quote. Instead, I have been pushed to ask uncomfortable questions in order to tell comprehensive stories. No administrator or advisor ever tried to silence my work or that of my peers. And that freedom not only provided me with an appreciation of those who face controversial topics head on each day, but also bolstered my confidence to pursue and tell stories that matter. Without a free student press, the country runs the risk of losing a professional vital to its democracy. We are, after all, the next generation of professionals. The freedom to ask difficult questions is at the heart of critical thinking and media literacy, something America just desperately needs more of these days. I'm not a journalist. At least, that's what I thought. But what I've come to understand is being a journalist is synonymous with ethical storytelling. A journalist is unafraid to ask tough questions and listen to all voices, even when it's uncomfortable. Telling stories that matter, that inform, and advance audiences is what drives me. So, yeah, I guess I'm a journalist. And now I don't shy from that title. And again, Joshua Tiggs is a digital media major at Buena Vista University, and he's a recipient of the 2022 Iowa College Media Association. And the opinion you heard before this was his teacher.
Okay, I'm going to go to letters to the editor. Our first letter is from David J. Nelson of Des Moines. Immunized leaders can eliminate rivals with impunity. Alexei Navalny's death is a direct result of Vladimir Putin's immunity from persecution. That immunity is exactly what Donald Trump is claiming to defend his autocratic behavior. That is un-American. Again from David J. Nelson. Flourishing or foundering? Governor Kim Reynolds has come up with a new motto for Iowa. The new motto is freedom to flourish. My question is, flourishing for who? Is it for children when funding for public education has been underfunded for a decade? Are hungry children flourishing when they don't have access to food? Are they flourishing when they drink dirty water, which causes cancer? Do they flourish when they are traumatized by gun violence at home or in school? Will they flourish with her science of reading approach? Do they flourish when Iowa's minimum wage is $7.25 and a living wage is $15? Do children flourish when their parents can't find good foods with good jobs with benefits for workers like union jobs provide? So when it comes to Iowa's children and families, Iowa is foundering under Republican leadership. Iowa is failing its children. If you care about children, if you care about families, if you care about Iowa, vote for Democrats in the primaries and in November. And that letter was from Kathy Geronzen of Cedar Rapids. Our next letter from Helen Duncan of Cedar Falls. Felons can't vote for president, but they can be president. Felons who have completed their sentences may apply to the governor to restore their voting rights. They may have a new career path. Skip the voting request, just run for president. Iowa might welcome you. Some Iowa legislators want Trump on the ballot, even if convicted of one or more felonies. And our last letter from Barbara Persoon of Pleasantville. Rigid thinking about gender is inaccurate and harmful. Variation is the hallmark of the human genome. Characteristics are not an either-or. They exist at disparate locations on a continuous spectrum. Skin tone is not black or white. Height is not either short or tall. There are different degrees of klutzes and athletes. Human traits run the gamut from one end of the scale to the other. These traits include gender and sexuality. Unfortunately, some small and petty minds are trying to stereotype human attributes into either or. They have constructed tight little boxes to their own specifications and are attempting to force us into them, whether we fit or not. It is not unlike attempting to force a size 10 foot into a size 7 shoe. It is painful, it makes it incredibly difficult to walk, and it is not an appropriate use of the shoe. Apparently, the governor and her legislature all wear size 7 and think the rest of us should, too. Since I am a size 11 on the spectrum of foot sizes, I strongly disagree. And again, that was from Barbara Persoon of Pleasantville.
I was going to read the other opinion off USA Today, but instead I thought I'd probably get into some sports, so we have some sports to give you today before we do Dear Abby. And the sports section today, lead story, McCaffrey has Iowa playing its best basketball. And I think I'll have time to get through most of it. If not, we'll move right on to something else. Chad Lisko wrote this. With the calendar deep in February, Fran McCaffrey has Iowa playing its best basketball of the season. Those familiar with the so-called Fran fade narrative may think that's something new, but it isn't. After Iowa's 78-71 win at Michigan State on Tuesday night, McCaffrey's teams are now 32-14 in the past six Februaries. The Hawkeyes, 16-11 and 8-8 in the Big Ten, entered this past weekend with zero quad one victories in the NCAA net. In a matter of 4 days, they now have two after back-to-back wins against Wisconsin and as 8.5-point underdogs at the Breslin Center. This was Iowa's best win of the year, no question about it. Prevailing on Tom Izzo's home floor is rare and never easy, but the Hawkeyes rode Patrick McCaffrey's hot shooting first half, one of Big Kirk's best games as a Hawkeye, 18 points and 14 rebounds, and Peyton Sanford's game-high 22 points to pretty much dominate. And suddenly, there are a lot more exciting possibilities on the table. At 500 in the conference, play with four games left, the Hawkeyes are in seventh place in the 14-team Big Ten. They now at least have a shot at an upper division conference finish for, get this, the 11th time in the past 12 seasons. Iowa's 10 upper division finishes in the past 11 years are tied for the most in the Big Ten with annual powerhouse Michigan State. In that same time period, Wisconsin has 9, Michigan, Ohio State and Purdue have 8. Maryland has 6 in 9 years. Illinois and Indiana are next with 4 apiece. 10 times. That's pretty impressive for little old Iowa. Spelled out, the Hawkeyes, starting with the 2012-13 season and counting ties, have finished 6th, 6th, 3rd, 3rd, 5th, 11th, 6th, 5th, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Big Ten play. McCaffrey's Hawkeyes also won the 2022 Big Ten tournament. Iowa went 5-2 in the February in 2019, 5-3 in 2020, 6-3 in 2021, 7-1 in 2022, 5-3 in 2023, and is now 4-2 so far in 2024 for a 70% February win rate. I asked McCaffrey recently what it takes to be in that position year after year. Somehow, some way, you've got to figure out how to win those games, McCaffrey said. He continued, that's easy. What you try to do is to create a culture where guys know how to compete and guys legitimately care about one another, end quote. Through the ups and downs, that's been clear from Iowa team leaders, Sanford, Patrick McCaffrey, and Tony Perkins. They have cited their close-knit group as being integral to being able to bounce back from disappointment. Hawkeyes haven't generated a big winning streak this year, but they have not fallen into a lengthy slide. And they are now 8-5 in their last 13 games and led 4 of those losses in the second half. They've been right there time after time, and the hope is now they've gotten over a bit of a bump, a bit of a hump. A team meeting following a road loss at Maryland has spurred Iowa's first two-game win streak since mid-January. McCaffrey stressed that the ability to stay the course is another key attribute in his team's being in postseason contention late in the hoops calendar. Sometimes you lose a couple or lose a tough one, and you might tend to stray away from the things that have typically worked, McCaffrey said. He went on, we kind of try to stay true to who we are, end quote. So why has the Fran fade notion persisted? It really started with the 2014 Hawkeyes and surged to number 10 in the national rankings in late January with a 15-3 record, but lost 8 of their final 13 regular season games. Then got stunned in the first round of the Big Ten tournament, then got relegated to the first 4 of the NCAA tournament, and lost there too. That team was exhausted emotionally as McCaffrey dealt with the cancer diagnosis of his son Patrick, who now is fifth-year senior player for the Hawkeyes and is 9 points shy of 1,000 for his career after 14 crucial ones on Tuesday. The following year, Iowa was 6-6 in the Big Ten play and finished 12-6, a 6-0 finish in Aaron White's senior season. No fade there. Iowa's 11-14 record in March since 2019 lingers, and Fran McCaffrey's lack of Sweet 16 appearance is the most discussed strike against his Hawkeye tenure. But Iowa's all-time winningest coach deserves credit for repeatedly putting his team in position to make some noise. And like clockwork, he's done that yet again. More work must be done. The games ahead won't be easy, and the path to a fifth straight NCAA tournament bid, and it would be going for 6 straight if not for COVID-19 cutting short the 2020 21 season remains a long shot, but a big opportunity is ahead at number 12 Illinois on Saturday. After losing the National Player of the Year, Luka Garza, in 2021, then first-round NBA draft picks in 2022, Keegan Murray and 2023 Chris Murray, this was not supposed to be an NCAA tournament team, but now there are flickers of hope. After the always heated visit to Champaign comes a home game versus Penn State, February 27, a road trip to Northwestern, March 2, and a finishing home game against the Fighting Illinois, March 10. Iowa probably needs to go 3-1 in this finishing stretch and then make some Big Ten tournament noise in Minneapolis to be in the NCAA conversation. So here we go again. Fran McCaffrey's guys in late February find themselves in the upper half of the Big Ten, and with that, at least an NCAA shot. And before I send it over to Teresa, I wanted to tell you what was planned on the tube tonight, and seeing how I don't seem to be able to find that, I can't. Oh, Teresa's got it.
I've got it right here, Doug. I'm just going to read a few. I know tonight, college women's basketball at 7 p.m. on Peacock. You can catch Iowa at Indiana. And if you'd rather watch NBA basketball, tonight at 6:30 p.m. on TNT, we have Phoenix at Dallas. And then after that game at 9 p.m., we've got the L.A. Lakers at Golden State. And now we'll turn to Dear Abby. Hosting mother-in-law complains for all to hear. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been married 3 years, and we generally trade off spending holidays with each of our families because none of our parents are willing to travel to us. We go to them. My mother-in-law takes great pride in hosting and sets a beautiful table. She'll spend an entire day in the kitchen, foregoing visiting with guests and wearing herself out to present an amazing dinner. If this brought her pleasure, there wouldn't be a problem. But, Abby, she complains bitterly about how tired she is, how much her feet hurt, how much work it is to have people in her home, and how she resents it. The thing is, she won't let us help. I've offered each time to help her cook, bring dishes made ahead of time, or take a turn so she can sit down. Each time, I have been sternly rebuffed, as if I've asked something embarrassing. When I tried leading the cleanup crew, her response was a hard no. I even suggested I come a day early and help with prep work. Also, no. I'm pretty sure she tells her friends she has lazy kids. Suggestions? And that was from Baffled in Pennsylvania. And Abby says, Dear Baffled, your mother-in-law appears to love to suffer. She is a martyr, so please stop attempting to deprive her of her pleasure. Try as you will, and have, you can't change her. Of course, you and her son could offer to take her and dad out for a lovely dinner. If you haven't already experienced enough rejection from the woman, you could give it a try, but don't be surprised if she refuses the offer or takes this personally. What she may say to her friends about you should not affect you. And our next letter, Dear Abby, I'd like your opinion regarding the financial help I give my sister. When her husband passed 18 months ago, it was clear she needed some help each month. I've been sending her $200, which I can afford for now. My husband and I are on Social Security. 8 months ago, she took in an old acquaintance for the purpose of collecting room rent. Turns out he can't or won't work, and she is supporting him now as well as sharing her bed. Also, their past relationship was disastrous. Both of them were alcoholics at the time. She has now resumed drinking with him after having quit a few years ago. Abby, I don't want my dislike for her lifestyle to impact my financial help, but on the other hand, I feel I'm being taken advantage of. Should I keep sending her money? And that was from Sour Sister in Illinois. And Abby says, Dear Sister, have a talk with Sissy. Tell her you have been sending her money because you felt she needed it after the death of her husband. Then remind her that she has a new partner in her home, her life, and her bed, and he should be contributing, which is why you will no longer be sending her money. She needs to hear it.
Thank you, Teresa. And before we close it off today, a little idea on what the weather is going to be. It's pretty nice out there. High today of 60, going to be a low of 32. Some clouds, breezy in the afternoon, and then it's clear tonight. Tomorrow, it's a 46 high and a 20 low, and cooler, becoming breezy. Saturday, 53, 34. These are really not February, but they're okay. I'll go for them. Sunny, breezy in the PM, Sunday 62, high 39 low, sunny and milder. So that's kind of a wrap-up of the weather. I want to tell you that that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been Teresa Whitaker. Earlier, you heard Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. Have a good day.